Assessing risk is a big consideration, a fear factor for some that affects all investors, from individuals to the largest institutions in the world. On this episode, the leaders of two major real estate strategies offer insights into the dynamics of risk, taking us inside their own approaches to portfolio strategy and management. They'll help us consider the interesting role of alternatives and understand key benchmarks.
The real important thing is to tease out where are you outperforming by understanding the risk better and taking less actual intrinsic risk by seeing opportunities where others aren't.
That's John Lipman, head of capital markets at Barings Real Estate, a U.S. and global platform that is part of the larger third-party asset management group owned by MassMutual. Barings has more than $450 billion of total assets under management, around $60 billion of which is invested in debt and equities across the real estate spectrum.
There is sometimes a tendency to look over your shoulder at your peer group and be cautious about extending yourself beyond the peer group's activity for fear of career risk or performance risk. But for those that use it more as a performance benchmark and market indicator, it is really useful.
And that's Liz Troney, portfolio manager of CBRE Investment Management's U.S. Direct Core Strategy. Overall, CBREIM has assets totaling around $150 billion under management. The flagship strategy Liz oversees has about 33% invested in alternatives, but primarily tracks the so-called Odyssey Index, O-D-C-E, that is, not Odyssey like Homer's Epic. We'll define that benchmark along with more expansive details in the conversation that follows. Coming up, an informative ode to portfolio strategy featuring two investment leaders who routinely make billion-dollar decisions. I'm Spencer Levy, and that's right now on The Weekly Take. Welcome to The Weekly Take, and we're here at 200 Park Avenue in New York talking about portfolio and fund strategy with John Lipman, Managing Director, Head of U.S. Real Estate Capital Markets, Barings. John, thanks for coming out.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And our old friend Liz Troney, Fund Manager, Managing Director, CBRE Investment Management. Liz, thanks for coming out today.
Thanks for having me, Spencer.
Well, let's dig a little bit more since this is about portfolio and fund strategy. Tell us what a Odyssey fund does as distinct from what other funds do.
Sure. So an Odyssey fund sits in the core bucket of risk. It serves as typically the first allocation for investors looking for the more conservative style of real estate investing. Most of the assets are stabilized. They're in proven locations, and the funds have been in existence, some from the 80s, some launched more recently in the last decade or so. So an array of vintage coming to the market, but they often form the initial entry point for institutional investors to core, secure, proven real estate.
John, turning to you now, let's start with your core vehicles and then we'll branch out.
And we have a variety of core vehicles, value add and opportunistic vehicles across the spectrum. One of the advantages of our platform is that we can invest in all kind of different environments through different vehicles that are focused on the appropriate time horizon and risk reward scenario in that environment. I think in terms of the growing amount of alternatives that's in different funds today, that reflects really the amount of transaction volume that are focused on alternatives. So when you look at different sectors that are not part of the four major food groups, those have been growing as a percentage of overall transaction volume over the years. And so it's no surprise that as the portfolios of core vehicles evolve, they follow that trajectory of transaction volume in the market.
So it's not just proactive, let's go buy data centers or senior housing or student housing, some kind of a niche sector. It's also reactive. The market has changed. And as the market changes, you change. Is that a good way to put it?
I think that every investor has to change with the market. And so you have to make the best investments that are available and that offer the best risk-adjusted returns in that market. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're seeing is investors expand to accept different classes of alternative investments as offering those attractive returns.
Liz focuses on core, but you have a variety of vehicles. Tell us how they work together.
Well, we have an allocation queue that's a normal part of our just investor compliance and making sure that all of our investors get a fair shake at the investments that are sourced through our platform, which spans the globe. And so we have different features that would allow different investment parameters that would make different investments appropriate for different vehicles. But on that spectrum of core to core plus to value add to opportunistic, clearly there's just a focus on the higher returns for taking more risk. And when we evaluate that, we look at a combination of both the redevelopment or development attributes of an asset and the combination of what percentage of the current value is coming from foreseeable cash flows and what is really on the back end on the sale of the asset at termination or at the end of our investment horizon as it's planned. And I think one thing where all of those strategies end up is to say, what's our exit back to a core vehicle at the end of the investment horizon? Just like a lender would say, what is the debt capacity at maturity for this asset to be refinanced? What is the exit for our equity investments that would marry up to a core vehicle? That is part of any analysis. It's not unique to us. I think that that's an appropriate way to view an investment.
And some people use the terminology in our business, build to core. And I think what you can also say is invest to core, meaning that you don't necessarily have to go ground up to build a core. You can buy a value-add asset and turn it into a core asset.
And I think we saw a lot of that in terms of what was going on with what I was call like scratch and dent multifamily, where people redo the kitchens and
time
the
out.
Bathrooms.
Scratch and dent multifamily. This is good. Keep
I was
going.
Thinking of a car park.
Well, when we think about scratch and dent multi, we think about, you know, like, you know, just things that you can see. You know, redo the kitchens and the baths, right? And what's the upside there? Now, clearly, multifamily hasn't been unscathed when you look at the different headwinds in terms of expense growth, in terms of cost of capital. But that build to core or renovate to core, mm-hmm. it's a pretty block and tackle approach, the first day of football season, block and tackle approach to achieving a business plan.
Liz, Odyssey funds or core funds, let's just be straight up. It wasn't the best run the last 4 years. It was tough. And it was tough as interest rates went up and core vehicles are much more interest rate sensitive because they have less margin there. You also had redemption queues, people wanting their money back. But things have gotten better recently. Why don't you tell us just the last 4 years to the present, not the whole story, just a summary of where we are today.
There was certainly a pullback in allocations or money earmarked for these funds, these Odyssey core funds over the last couple of years. And that's one of the features of open-end funds is that you offer investors their right to liquidity in your fund. And then you have to match that liquidity by often selling assets, which are hard assets and may not meet the timetable of the investors to receive their money back. So the funds received redemptions as interest rates moved up and the expected return for real estate was not as competitive with other asset classes, but the funds struggled in then a declining market to sell as many assets as they needed to meet the investors' requirements for their funds back. And so we had a bit of a mismatch between investors' expectations for liquidity in the market and the fund manager's ability to meet that by selling. So redemption queues this cycle versus the GFC, which was the last time we saw this spike in redemption queues in Odyssey, were larger and they were longer. So the duration and the depth of the what we call the queues to manage was greater. We're now coming out of that. There is an unfreezing of the majority of funds with at least less pressure. A number of funds have now zero queues. So we have a kind of league table with funds moving towards very limited to single digit percentage of NAV queues. So less pressure on those funds. Some of the larger ones still have a lot to handle, but overall the pressure has certainly reduced. New allocations are few and far between, but we are starting to see them come back. And the more dominant funds, typically with the alternative bias, are seeing an outsized share of that new capital for core funds.
John?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, and it speaks to the way that all kinds of real estate investments fit within an investor's portfolio construction. So having that liquidity in an open-ended fund might be appropriate for some investors. Having a closed-ended vehicle where there's a target date, which they're trying to sell the assets in the fund by, different strategies, they speak to different opportunities in the market, and they fit in different ways in institutional investors' overall asset allocations. And when we look at investors in different parts of the market, we can see how that plays in and how different investment vehicles can be suitable for different investors. And at Barings, that's one of our strengths, to have those different vehicles be available for different investor goals.
let me dive into alternatives because they keep coming up here, which is unusual in a core discussion. And I say why it's unusual. It's unusual because alternatives are considered alternatives because they are more operationally intensive than the big four: office, industrial, multifamily, and retail. But yet we're going into them. Yet we're going into data centers, senior housing, student housing, SFR, BTR, single family rental, build to rent stuff. How'd you get comfortable with that, Liz? How do you get comfortable with that shift?
Quick response is most, if not all, real estate has become more operational. So there's been a broader acceptance of that, largely driven by shorter lease lengths, even in the more traditional areas. So we've had to accept real estate as a service and operational real estate being a much larger component of the driver of value versus the traditional rent collection, irrespective of the sector label. But more directly in response, it is challenging to overcome the history, the data, the lack of familiarity over market cycles with those areas. And so we lean heavily into specialism and we lean heavily into edge of the specialist and particularly the operational capability and niche of the entity, the company, the partner that we have that we're working with. So typically there is an intermediary between us and the real estate that has a particular niche serving that tenant base or serving that real estate product type.
I agree with you, by the way. Most real estate has gotten more operationally intensive. But there's also been another change in our business. And the other change in our business is that large traditional real estate investors are not just buying an individual asset. They are sometimes buying the operating companies themselves. So, John, what's your point of view of going direct to the real estate, buying piece of OpCo, or both?
I think in any investment, you have to understand both the real estate and how the business plan is going to be achieved and how the real estate's going to be operated. So any investor would be wise to focus on not only what looks good on paper, but also the operating partner's ability to achieve what's set forth in front of them and their track record, and even an investment manager who has a track record of working with different operators in a space is better suited to make investment decisions into non-core assets than a core operator that maybe has less of a familiarity with non-core investments and non-core operators. You know, the old adage, right, character first of investing, right? Who are you investing with? What's their experience? Can they actually achieve the business plan and can they operate the property efficiently is more and more and more important, and it was very important to begin with. So I think as we get into alternatives more, as we expand the universe of investments, the people involved in the business, and real estate is always a people business, the people involved become super, super important.
Well, not as catchy as scratch and dent multi, which, by the way, I wrote down. I'm going to use that this entire episode. I think it's fair to say that the operator matters more than the real estate. Good operators matter more than good real estate.
I don't know if they matter. Maybe I oversimplify. They don't matter more, but it matters as much. If you have an operation-intensive real estate investment, just think of a hotel and sort of the 4+1 of alternatives, right? Of that hospitality asset, you have to have an operator who knows how to run a hotel, whether it's a limited service hotel or a top-notch 5-star property. That experience, super important, and will contribute to the success or failure of that investment beyond if it's just a well-located asset. And I think Liz really got to where you see operations matter more is where leases are shorter and shorter. So the shorter the leases, the more touch points with the cash flow, mm-hmm. with the sales, whether it's a room night, whether it's a one-year lease, whether it's a semester, whatever, that it just starts to feel more palpable.
Is it fair to say, maybe this is unfair to say, that core vehicles need to take more operational risk to achieve the same return goals? Is that a fair statement?
I think that is fair. And what John was aptly summarizing in some sense is operational alpha becoming a requirement for core funds to outperform that index. And the operational alpha can come from the partner. It could come from intrinsic understanding of that sector and the actual on-the-ground operations in terms of revenue optimization, et cetera. But certainly operational alpha and that reaching for additional sources of excess return to outperform the index or maintain a competitive position has become critical.
John, were you jumping there?
I 100% agree with that.
All right, we'll go with that too. I think one of the beauties of the Odyssey Index is that it is as transparent as any vehicle there is in our entire industry, with the exception of publicly traded vehicles. And I know in the debt side, people are trying to now do their version of an Odyssey Index to try to gain transparency. So Liz, how would you describe that transparency of Odyssey funds versus other types of real estate vehicles?
We think of it like the S&P 500 for institutional real estate. Data goes back, as I mentioned, late 70s, early 80s. It's quarterly. It's transparent. It's structured for a common purpose. You can stick it into any multi-asset optimizer, and it'll work up against equities and fixed income. It's probably the only market in the world that has that level of transparency, and that has, with its transparency, encouraged allocations over time. Elsewhere where that transparency is reduced or not available, allocations have been slower to grow and less persistent. So it's benefited the industry in many ways. It also allows, we call it as a joke, rubbernecking a bit. So there is sometimes a tendency to look over your shoulder at your peer group and be cautious about extending yourself beyond the peer group's activity for fear of career risk or performance risk. But for those that use it more as a performance benchmark and market indicator, it is really useful, as John was saying earlier, in terms of indicating asset allocation decisions, not only from core, but where is the non-core capital going to go and try and sell into in the future in terms of appetite from core capital. So it has a bit of a virtuous cycle to it, but the transparency is globally unique. And with it has come enduring and persistent allocations, because the consultant world, the advisory world, and the institutional market has a lot of trust and faith in being able to look back so far.
Just on that transparency point, the attribution analysis that goes into Odyssey returns is really, really unique. And understanding what's coming from income versus capital appreciation within an investment vehicle, as opposed to just looking at your IRR based on wherever the point is of valuation and not really understanding what's coming from where, that's just it's a great element of transparency.
Yeah.
And investors appreciate that.
So, and it helps you measure your alpha, right? You can actually clinically, numerically measure your alpha against your peer set. So you show up every quarter with a new performance ranking. You just have to resist that quarter to quarter, because it is a long-term game. These are hard assets, and typically investors invest for the long term. So resisting that quarterly rubbernecking is important, but it is hugely valuable in terms of understanding the value you're offering as an investor.
I think really from a competitive environment, when you're in a race and it's a long race to build the cumulative excess returns that satisfy investors while mitigating risk, the ability to know where your competitors are, the ability to understand how they're pricing their assets, and you can derive from that how they're pricing risk, it's a really important tool, and it's helpful. I think investors do that in their overall portfolio allocations, their portfolio constructions, their allocations to equity and debt, and then their allocations to different risk parameters within that. And in some cases, their reliance on the manager to make those allocations across different asset types. Even within a core vehicle or between vehicles, you know, there is a, not everything has to be core within a core vehicle. Not everything has to be through the investment sleeve. Sometimes the decision is left to the manager in terms of where that relative value lies.
Now, we had on this show maybe a year ago our friend Drew Fung from Clarion, big debt guy, and he's trying to do a Odyssey index for debt for this very same reason. People say, well, I don't want this much rubbernecking of my competitors or that much transparency. He completely disagrees with that. He says, you know what? This is actually a good thing if there's transparency, because the challenges of fundraising are hard enough. But if you give people less transparency, it's even harder. So speaking from the debt side, John, what's your point of view?
Well, I think, you know, CREFC, Lisa Pendergrass over there who runs CREFC, is working on a similar thing. And look, it's always good to know what the benchmarks are. I think everybody has to be honest with themselves about their own performance and be able to speak to that performance in terms of evaluating what alpha they're adding and to be able to attract capital. So I don't have any problem with benchmarking in any sense. I think you have to just understand how the benchmark is aggregated, and so that if there's a difference in terms of performance relative to that benchmark, that you can articulate
why you're better or worse and what's driving that difference. If you're underperforming because you're not taking as much risk, it might be justified on the debt side. If you're overperforming because you're taking more risk, it might be justified. The real important thing is to tease out where are you outperforming by understanding the risk better and taking less actual intrinsic risk by seeing opportunities where other aren't. And I think that's what every investment manager tries to talk to investors about and to demonstrate their ability. At Barings, we demonstrate that ability to our investors, and we try to attract more capital by demonstrating that ability. We think it's the most valuable thing to investors.
And I think what's important here is there are certain types of risk that are appropriate for your vehicle. There are certain that are not appropriate for your vehicle. If somebody's investing in a core fund, you're not going to go into a secondary market, build a highly risky asset type, and hope for the best. That's very good for an opportunistic investor. And maybe they'll make higher returns, but also the beta on that one is, and we since we brought in alpha, let's bring in the beta. The deviation from the mean is something that would be even more. So you're limited in the types of risks that you can and should take. Fair point?
Yeah, fair point. I break it down thinking of risk and bridging off what John was saying between leverage, repositioning, and development risk. So depending on whether you're a core all the way up the spectrum to opportunistic, that leverage, repositioning, and development are your levers of risk to play with, if you like. And to John's point, I think it's really apt to speak to investors about the actual risk you're taking and encourage them to look on a risk-adjusted basis at net outcomes. I think in real estate, we're not necessarily there yet. I don't even know if the equities market is there in terms of investors' interpretation of outcomes, but it's a critical point. I really agree with you. But typically, investors are rushed. They have a lot of things they're managing at the same time, and they'll look at the top-line number and judge you as equivalent to peers that may have more or less risk within their vehicle. But certainly, Spencer, there's appropriate, if you like, risk to be taken within the different risk styles, but those three levers are common to all risk styles. You just dial it up or down depending on hopefully the communication and transparency with your investors and the appropriateness of that risk within
Good
your
job.
Style.
And I think my recollection is right. I think that the attribution analysis for the returns in the Odyssey Index includes what the impact of leverage is on that return. And so you can get a better sense of, you know, where the balance sheet strategy has added value on the right side, as opposed to just focusing on, you know, how the assets are performing. And I think Odyssey funds are typically plus minus 30% leverage, and that's much lower leverage than is used widely in the market. And so understanding that as far as an Odyssey fund is critical, because you have a different leverage usage than you would in maybe more typical levered real estate investment.
So Liz, I like the way you broke down risk, because you broke it down into three categories. You broke it down into leverage, reposition, and development. And John was added the 30% plus or minus leverage that you have in core funds. I might add a fourth one, and I just your point of view, which is imperfect naming, market and liquidity. Is market liquidity a subcategory of that, or would you say that's another category of risk?
I agree with you. Based on that simplistic breakdown, would be another category, and that feeds into common hurdle rates for investors probably across all risk styles in terms of how much additional return am I requiring for this potential illiquidity of a smaller market. So I think there's a common approach to include that in a hurdle rate and therefore require an excess return to a primary market. One can argue whether that's appropriate or not, and I agree with you that in this environment we are seeing advantageous understanding of secondary markets. I used to have an old boss who said, don't fear the second tier. And I feel we're back in a don't fear the second tier environment. And we are seeing in our own research, which we work with your side of the business all the time with Spencer, we've done an analysis called the next Nashville, trying to find where is the next Nashville in the country going to surface. And that's brought us not to New York City, not to San Francisco. Clearly, it's brought us to markets in the Midwest. It's brought us out west to markets that many of us wouldn't be that familiar with, you know, suburbs of Salt Lake City, not even Salt Lake City itself, looking for a common checklist of factors that are appropriate for core capital, but actually we would highlight as being underrepresented in the Odyssey Index. So have a current lower institutional market saturation or even just general transaction activity, and that being a positive rather than a detractor for their next Nashville ranking.
I think there are two great points there. First of all, don't fear the second tier. We are just a treasure trove of great expressions today. I'm stealing that one. We'll give Liz or Liz's former boss credit for that one. Taking the Salt Lake City example, what do you think about that, John?
Well, I mean, Silicon Slope has been a fantastic area. It happens to be in between a world-class airport and four amazing mountains to ski. There's a lot of just attractiveness in terms of lifestyle and in terms of livability that brings people to an area that's also been able to generate the jobs to support them. So I think that's been a great opportunity just for that market. I think you're right, Liz. There are other markets that will follow that as affordability is important. People need to be able to live in a lifestyle that they're aspiring to. And people may find it more easy to do that in a secondary market than in one of the traditional primary markets. So I think capital will follow that. You look at the old block and tackle, again, of, you know, household formation following job growth, following, you know, lifestyle, right? Those are key demand drivers of what's going to push every kind of real estate demand, from retail to industrial to obviously residential and even office. And, you know, in those markets, we're also seeing more employers being able to attract people to the office, right? Because they don't mind going. It's sort of the path of growth.
I'll bring up one other market, and this is a show that we just aired a couple of weeks ago, which was West Palm Beach. We had Stephen Ross on the show, and he was focusing on West Palm Beach, which was, it was very secondary. And when they built City Place, Related built City Place 20 years ago, it was not a huge hit out of the box. But now the highest rents achieved in Florida are in West Palm Beach. That is a example. What do you think, Liz?
Yeah, as an investor over market cycles, there's an immediate reaction, which is, are we reaching for yield again? And is it that same reach for yield thesis? But when you look back, which has actually proven out, so that reach for yield thesis over the last 12, 15 years into markets like Austin, into markets like Raleigh, into markets like Boulder, has actually proven out to be successful, even in a QE, in a lower interest rate environment where we had a bandwidth of 0 to 2% yields. In an environment where we're 4 to 5% base rates, then certainly looking for excess return with a consistent checklist of factors, which I think West Palm Beach would qualify. Lower cost of entry to primary, as John was saying, underrepresented, strong fundamentals, educated workforce. And in the case of Florida versus Salt Lake City, one of the largest drivers globally is temperature. So understanding that move to the Sun Belt was in part a rational move to a better climate by that large swath of a population, then I think there's a lot of merit in this. And over or excess caution by investors in terms of a natural reaction to that reach for yield, and will I ultimately be better served by the primary? I think we just need to unwind that behavior.
And just to piggyback on what Liz was saying, it's important, though, as investors stretch from traditional markets to second-tier markets, tertiary markets, that they approach those investments with the humility to understand that they maybe don't know everything about those markets. It's another reason to really work with great local operators who understand the nuances of the market, and local lenders who understand the nuances of the market, to really tease out where that risk is and understand where the path of growth is in those markets. So whether it's Salt Lake City or West Palm Beach or anywhere in between, these markets, you have to approach them with the idea that you don't know everything about why that corner may be good or bad or where the housing paths are or not, and just approach them with that sensitivity and caution. Not everything is going to go maybe the same way in a new market. There are nuances that have to be considered.
And Liz used the term stretching for yield. I've heard another term, I think it's a synonym, is it called a yield trap. And what a yield trap is when you stretch to another market and say, oh, look, I can get this industrial deal for 100 basis point less in Salt Lake City than I can in Southern California. But they might not have the durable demand drivers, or it's not as deep of a market. And to John's point, I think the liquidity and the knowledge base in Southern California, nothing personal, Salt Lake City, is much deeper than it is in Salt Lake City. So the risk profile from a pure underwriting perspective is lower there from knowing the market. Is that a fair way to kind of look at SoCal, say, versus Salt Lake City?
Yeah, and I was just thinking, as you were clearly describing that, that for core funds who don't have the mandated exit, a harvest period, and then a mandated exit of returning proceeds, that can be more flexible on their exit, the reach, if you like, or the search for value in secondary markets is probably more rational, because one of the trade-offs of a less liquid market is potential volatility on your exit. If you have to sell at a certain time in a less liquid market, you're likely to potentially take greater volatility on your exit price, because there's probably a thinner bidder pool there.
That's very interesting, because I've actually never heard it expressed quite like that, Liz. You're saying because of the time period differences that actually core funds have greater flexibility to go to some of these secondary, tertiary markets.
Yeah, and I've got a great example. So in our fund, we lean heavily into secondary markets and industrial. So not the Southern California, not the Port of New Jersey, but markets like Indianapolis, markets like Memphis. In the rise of those primary markets post-COVID, and that extrapolated period of such strong growth for the port markets, we were underperforming. Now, with the call that you made years ago around nearshoring, Spencer, and the marginal shift in production to the domestic market, we're actually reconsidering our exit in parts of Indianapolis and Memphis, because now they may be more valuable to us than the primary. And that represents that flexibility of a hold period within a core fund, where if you are in a closed-end vehicle required to distribute proceeds back to investors, your exit timing is less, potentially less flexible.
John, we talked a lot about secondary markets. We talked a little bit about the asset types. I also note that you're partners with one of our companies, the Trammell Crow Companies, on a deal called Speedway Industrial in El Paso, which is Exhibit A of going to a secondary market, doing new development in industrial. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we're really excited about that opportunity. We have approximately 800,000 square feet under development with Trammell Crow right outside of El Paso. It's a growing market. We started that development earlier this year, and we think it represents a great expansion of our relationship with Trammell Crow. It's our first joint venture with them, but they're obviously leaders in the market, have a lot of local know-how, and it's that combination of local know-how and institutional capital that we think will really make for a winning investment.
And by the way, I'm very bullish on El Paso specifically, and the reason why is, in fact, I love the cross-border trade, because there are certain competitive advantages in Mexico, there's certain competitive advantages in the United States, and El Paso is right at the crossroads.
You know, there's one other thing about that investment that's important, and that is the willingness of the city to provide a pro-business investment environment that will attract that capital and attracts our partners to them as well. So I think the municipality, the overall economic story, the operating expertise, the institutional capital, it's sort of, you know, four legs of a stool that really should prove to attract more capital to those kind of investments.
So given that you're wearing two hats here today, John, both an equity and a debt hat, how do you see interest rates just generally impacting both sides of the house? But do you agree that for the last couple of years, it was actually pretty good for debt funds in terms of getting equity-type returns?
It certainly was. And that was a function in part of a lack of value growth. So the returns that were driving the debt side of the house has been just consistent income. Spreads have come in. There's a lot of liquidity that's returned to the debt markets. And there's plenty of additional dry powder on the sidelines. To the extent that there are higher underlying rates or lower underlying rates, that's going to impact all investors. It may impact the debt capacity of assets going forward. So that just means there'll be a larger amount of equity that has to come in. And typically, that just has a higher cost of capital. So that decreases value as cost of capital rises. But the fundamental returns that have attracted capital to the debt side of the equation, I think that will continue. There's another thing that's attracting capital to debt funds, which is the availability of senior financing in many regards. And so there's a leverage that's available within the debt universe to provide investors in private credit a higher risk-adjusted return for their retained position, whether they're 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1 leverage, and so forth. And there's a variety of different ways to get at that. So when we look at debt investors, we really have to evaluate, you know, what are they looking for? Are they looking for maybe the more senior part of the capital stack, which is trading relative to where corporate bonds and corporate credits are trading and where that offers additional return on the safer side? Or are we looking more into the leverage stack, where it's a levered play that offers a different return dynamic in terms of current pay versus appreciation relative to the equity. And so that back and forth and understanding those different links and what the investment in real estate is an alternative to in a more traditionally allocated portfolio is where we see different investors play.
So looking forward, Liz, we've had a stretch now where it was very difficult for core funds, but now it's getting better. Given where we are today, where are we going with core funds over the next couple of years?
The big question for investors is this continual path into alternatives and or at the same time a reassessment of basis on the traditional sectors, which can at one point sound conflictual or contradictory. But we are seeing volumes of capital focused in the alternative areas. The capital, therefore, is competing those yields down to levels that now are competitive with more traditional sectors historically. And the basis on traditional office, the basis on retail, including open air, which is now very widely accepted, Spencer, thanks to your call years ago, to be attractive. So, but still value there. And that's the question for funds that are in a privileged position, have some alternatives, and they're just trying to find the best relative value available. And is that a continual lurch into alternatives, into early mover advantage in some of the areas that you outlined earlier? Or is it an acceptance and a behavioral open-mindedness that there is basis to be found, there is attractive entry points, once again, back where we started with office and retail?
John, how do you see the next several years playing out?
I see a lot more capital coming into real estate, whether it's in private credit or private equity vehicles, in part as a function of increased allocations to alternatives within retirement accounts. That will be a major driver of liquidity into real estate and will help drive down cap rates even if interest rates rise. And I think it will help drive down spreads even if interest rates rise. So I think that there's a bullish case to be made for real estate, notwithstanding also the fundamentals, but just from a capital flow perspective. If that untapped pool of liquidity comes into real estate, it looks like it will continue to come, that there will be enough additional investor demand that needs to be accessed, that it will buoy a lot of investments to the good for everybody.
So on behalf of the Weekly Take, what a terrific conversation today with our friends from Barings and CBREIM. Liz, thanks for joining the show.
Great to be here. Thanks, Spencer.
John, thanks for joining the show.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much, Spencer.
Appreciate you coming in today.
We'll have more investment-focused conversations coming soon, including a return to London to learn about REITs in the UK. Plus, a conversation with an entrepreneur and author will tell us how one of his book subjects, pirates, yes, pirates, can teach us about business. Shiver me timbers. You can stay on top of what's coming on the show by visiting our website, cbre.com/theweeklytake. You'll also find lots of other useful insights about investing, management, development, and operations across the real estate spectrum, with episodes and content archived there. It's available on all major podcast platforms too. So we encourage you to peruse our full catalog and, of course, to share the show, subscribe, and send us your feedback. As always, thanks for joining us. I'm Spencer Levy. Be smart, be safe, be well.